Good afternoon. You are tuned into a Juno Afternoon here for Friday, the 29th of July in the year 2016. Jeff Brown with you on the show today. We'll be talking to Jeff Brady and Dave Sexton, authors of the second edition of the Skagway Police Blotter book. We'll talk with Brenda Weaver about the celebration surrounding the release of the new Harry Potter book. We'll talk to Steve Kerwood, host of Public Radio's Living on Earth. And we'll talk with Emma Davidson about her workshop on Felted Animals tomorrow. That writer's almanac. We're not using more to you on Juno Afternoon.
With National Native News, I'm Stephen Emmons, in for Antonia Gonzalez. Coalition of groups is organizing a march and protest in Winslow, Arizona, following the Maricopa County Attorney's decision to not charge a police officer in the shooting death of a Navajo woman in March. Organizers of the event say they want an independent outside investigation into the shooting. They also insist on compensation for the family of L'Oreal Sinigini. She was killed during an altercation with Winslow police officer Austin Shipley following a shoplifting complaint. The police department released edited video this week from the camera Shipley wore during the shooting. Nick Estes is a co-founder of the group Red Nation, one of the organizers of the protest. He says the police are not responding adequately to the increasing evidence that more people of color die at the hands of police.
I know from personal experience that a lot of community don't call the police because they're afraid of what might happen. You know, and if we go back to the lapel camera, it's like that was a police reform measure. It was supposed to stop or at least deter that kind of behavior, and it had zero impact in this case.
Advocacy groups are pushing for an investigation by the U.S. Department of Justice. Many groups and organizations are reacting to the announcement that the port of Churchill in northern Manitoba is shutting down. Local First Nations officials say they were blindsided by the news. More from Dan Karpinchuk.
The community of Churchill is in shock. The Transportation Workers Union was told employees were being laid off and that the small seasonal port on the coast of Hudson Bay won't be operating this year. Farmers groups have also reacted since many grain farmers depend on the port to help get their grain to export markets. Without Churchill, their costs will certainly increase. And Manitoba's regional chief with the Assembly of First Nations, Kevin Hart, says he's concerned about what the closure will mean for communities near the rail line into Churchill, and the impact on more than just people in Manitoba.
And I think that the federal government really does need to step up to save the port of Churchill at this time.
The U.S. company that owns the port, Omnitrax, announced a tentative agreement in principle last year with a group of First Nations to sell. Hart says supplies and fuel are shipped through the port of Churchill and will affect people in Nunavut and the Northwest Territories. The provincial government says it's received assurances that freight services along the rail line to Churchill will continue, including shipments of subsidized fresh food. It's also working with the federal government to see what more can be done, the plan being to come up with a strategy to reverse the closure. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
It was Hillary Clinton's big night at the Democratic National Convention in Philadelphia, but her speech to the party faithful had little effect on at least one Alaska Native in the audience. Gavin Hudson is a member of the Metlakatla Indian community and an alternate delegate from Alaska. He cast his vote in favor of Clinton, but says he remains a Bernie Sanders supporter. He says he's not clear where Clinton stands on the issues, such as sovereignty, that are most important to his community.
I don't know. And I think that's a problem. I think she could do a lot better job in communicating that and broadcasting those kinds of her positions and how she feels about us and what she respects about sovereignty or not. It's a mystery, I don't know.
Hudson says he appreciates Sanders' efforts to outreach to Native communities. One group of young people was at the convention to experience the political process up close and develop leadership skills. George Washington University's Native American Political Leadership Program brought a handful of Native high school students to Philadelphia. Nicholas Courtney, a member of the Macaw Nation, is an alumnus of the program and is now the program's manager. He says the political convention is an eye-opening experience for many of the program's participants, some of whom have not traveled far from their reservations.
When we're in these meetings, in these Native Council meetings, and they see themselves, people in their communities, represented and engaging in political systems, I think that they say, you know, I can do this, like that could be me there.
The George Washington University program also sent one student to the Republican National Convention. For National Native News, I'm Stephen Emmons.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation.
Support for this program is provided by the Native American Rights Fund, reminding you that sovereignty is not free. Since 1970, NARF has stood firm for justice in Indian country on critical issues like treaty enforcement, hunting and fishing rights, Indian child welfare, religious freedom, and more. You too can become a modern-day warrior. Stand firm with NARF. Learn more at narf.org and join the fight for Native rights.
Native Voice 1, the Native American Radio Service.
It's 6 minutes past the hour, and you are tuned to Juno Afternoon. Our first guests in the studio are Jeff Brady and Dia Sexton from Skagway, here to talk about the second volume of Skagway Police Blotter. Thank you for coming to the station today.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jeff.
So for people who aren't familiar with Skagway or have an idea of what it is, could you please tell us about Skagway?
Skagway is unique. Skagway, from the police standpoint, is amazingly quiet. It's the most peaceful, quiet community, I think, in all of Alaska. But again, like Ketchikan or Juneau, we get our days in the summer where, you know, we'll have 10,000 visitors in town. So that's different. You know, we're the same size as, say, Hoonah, but we've got 20 restaurants in town. We've got several hundred motel rooms in town. We've got several hundred RV stops in town. So, I mean, it's big. We're a town of about 1,000 most of the year. In the summer, we turn into a big college town, kind of. We probably import 1,000 young people to lead tours and drive buses and make pizzas and make beds. So we kind of pick up a certain kind of college town flavor, I think.
Is the tourism a double-edged sword?
It's been very, very good to us economically. I mean, Skagway has things that you're not going to find anywhere else. But we also do an awful lot of EMS runs. We do an awful lot of it certainly puts a toll. It puts a tax on what we can and can't provide.
But it's a fun town.
It is. It's a great town.
Police Blotter. This is the second volume that just came out. First one you printed about 3,000 copies, and now you're ready for another a few more. Tell me where the idea came from to do the first one.
I think most newspapers, Jeff's got the biweekly paper in town, and most small town papers, most large papers, like Juno does it, you know, they'll print the police activity. I've always thought it's been really, really important that the community knows what the police are doing. I think it's good for the police for the community to know what they're doing. I think it's good for the community to know what they're up to. So you put these little news nuggets in every week. We've kind of done it with a flair. We've kind of done it where it's interesting. We've kind of done it where it's fun. Jeff can speak to these. Our blotter was picked up statewide for a long time.
Yeah, and that's kind of how the book came about, is there was interest in reprinting parts of our blotter in the Anchorage Daily News back 20 years ago when they had that kind of Dispatch Alaska. We were kind of one of their favorite go-to places for just kind of quirky stuff. And so we decided, well, we've got enough now to where we can put a book together, and we packaged it with some kind of oddball features that Mike Seeker wrote initially when he was up in Skagway. And it made a great book. And this time around, we were ready to do it again. The other book was out of print, and Dave had been away from the community a few years, but he had come back, and he was back on the blotter beat, and we just got talking about a year or so ago about putting it together again, and it was a fun project again.
What do you think a police blotter has to say about it, the community it comes from?
Well, it's a picture of activity of the police, but it also, you know, it's... You know, you're going to have, you know, when there's a DUI arrest or something like that, all that sort of thing's in there. But also when you hear about a kid who wandered away from his parents, you're going to read about that. You're going to read about doors being unlocked and, you know, all kinds of things. It's a good kind of window into the community. And then Dave kind of has a little flair for it, and it's good. It's fun reading.
Most of the reading, the items I saw were, I guess, termed as cute. No, nobody really got hurt. Does that mean there's no crime at all in Skagway?
You know, we've had, in the last couple of years, we've had two very significant arsons, very serious, significant arsons. We've had a serious shooting in the last year, a serious knifing in the last year. But I teach at for UAS. I teach in their criminal justice program. And I had a student who was out of Craig. He was a sergeant at Craig, and we were discussing caseloads a while back. And Craig has a 5-person police department. We have a 4-person police department. The towns are a little similar. I mean, they're semi-comparable. Craig annually, pretty steadily, makes about 500 arrests a year. We don't make 50. So I think that says a whole lot about the flavor of the town.
Now, you've been listening to us talk about the book. Could you give us a sample of some of the entries?
Well, I'll read a couple of my favorites. This is a classic from Moe's Frontier Bar, an old bar in Skagway that has since closed. But on August 14th, 2007, from the police blotter, a porcupine was found inside a bar. He was 86'd by an officer with help from patrons. This is the same porcupine that left quills and two dogs in town on August 11th. He was identified by the lack of quills when confronted. And then we have a picture of him being escorted out of the bar by the officer. And then just, I'll read a couple more. This is one of my favorite DUI calls ever. A driver made the error in judgment of yelling and waving a beer can at an officer on foot patrol as he sped past. And it just kind of bring you up to date with the modern world. Police received many noise complaints about late night fireworks, but were unable to catch anybody firing them off. The next day, officers located and cited a local 16-year-old female who had bragged on her Facebook account how she was responsible for waking the entire town.
And that describes Skagway pretty well.
Yeah.
So for Volume 2, you came out, you added another kind of section to it.
Yeah, we had started up a column called Heard on the Wind. And Heard on the Wind is all the kind of goofy questions that the tourists will ask you. And, you know, it's you get the usual stuff like,
the elevation?
Yeah, what's the elevation? How do you get the glacier so shiny? Who goes up there and polishes it at night? What time do the northern lights come on? And it's fun stuff. But we get some kind of unique ones in Skagway. Is the snow real, or do you spray it up there for the tourists? People are looking up all the time. They're very confused when they arrive on the ship about where they are. A local was down in the harbor parking lot the other day, noticing how low the tide was. She looked up, saw a tourist standing there looking at her, and remarked, "Wow, this is an extremely low tide. I don't think I've noticed a low tide like this before." And the visitor replied, "Oh, I was thinking the same thing. Have you not had much rain lately?" And, it's just crazy stuff. A visitor was overheard asking where a local one might find pictures of Sarah Palin in a bathing suit. We got lots of that one year. A tour operator was asked, "How old does a deer have to be before you call it a moose?" And we've had the same question about caribou. How old do they have to be when they turn into a moose?
I don't think I'll ask it any.
Yeah.
Are you having a book signing tonight? 4 to 6.
We are. We're going to be at Hearthside Books downtown in less than an hour. It starts at 4 o'clock, and we'll go till about 6. And, we hope to see a lot of our Juno friends there, and you can pick up a copy. It's a fun book to have in your favorite reading spot in your town.
We had a lot of people laughing at our house. So congratulations on putting together a great book.
All right.
Anything you'd like to add I might have forgotten to ask?
No, we just had a lot of fun putting the project together. We're glad it's the blotter's back in circulation again. And, we're looking forward to seeing folks out there tonight. Thanks.
Dave Sexton, thank you very much.
Thank you.
right to arrest. I'm the guy who's a boss on this highway. So watch out what you're doing when you're driving my way. If you break the law, you'll hear from me. I know I'm a working for the state. I'm the highway patrol. Well, you'll know me when you see me, 'cause my door's painted white, with my siren is screaming and my flashing red light. I work all day and I work all night, just to keep a law and order, trying to do what's right. If I write you out a ticket, then you better drive slow. I'm just doing my job, I'm the highway patrol. I'm the highway patrol, the highway patrol. My hours are long and my pay is low, but I'll do my best to keep you driving slow. I'm just doing my job, I'm the highway patrol. Shouldn't do. You can bet your boots I'm coming after you. If you want to race, then get on a racetrack. Well, if you try to run away, I'm going to bring you back. I'm here to keep all the speeders driving slow. I'm just doing my job. I'm the highway patrol. I'm the highway patrol, the highway patrol. My hours are long and my pay is low, but I'll do my best to keep you driving slow. I'm just doing my job, I'm the highway patrol. I'm just doing my job, I'm the highway patrol.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Friday, the 29th of July, 2016. It's the birthday of the newspaper columnist Don Marquis, born in Walnut, Illinois, 1878, who invented the characters Archie the Cockroach and Mehitabel the Alley Cat. It's the birthday of Alexis de Tocqueville, born in Paris, 1805. He was 25 years old when the French sent him to America to study the American prison system, spent 9 months traveling around the country taking notes, and a few years later he published his famous book, Democracy in America. Alexis de Tocqueville, impressed by the fact that American democracy actually worked, he wrote, "America demonstrates invincibly one thing that I had doubted up to now, that the middle classes can govern a state, despite their small passions, their incomplete education, their vulgar habits. They can obviously provide a practical sort of intelligence, and that turns out to be enough." And it's the birthday of the poet Stanley Kunitz, born in Worcester, Massachusetts, 1905. His father committed suicide in a public park before Kunitz was born. His mother erased all traces of the father from the house, refused to talk about him. But she did not destroy the books that the father had left behind, including the dictionary, which became one of Stanley Kunitz's favorite books. He opened it up every day to find a new word. He liked big words, like eleemosynary or phantasmagoria. His first job was riding a horse down the streets of Worcester and lighting the gas lamps at night. He became a reporter for the Worcester Telegram, went off to Harvard, stayed for his master's degree, lived on a big farm in Connecticut, worked as a reporter and a farmer, was drafted into World War II, became a teacher at Bennington College, where he refused to expel a student who the president of the college wanted to expel, and when the president of Bennington showed up at Kunitz's house, Kunitz took a potted plant and threw it in the president's face and then left for good. His third book came out in 1958, Selected Poems. It was rejected by 8 publishers, 3 of whom even refused to read it. And when it was finally published, it won the Pulitzer Prize. Stanley Kunitz, who said, "It is out of the dailiness of life that one is driven into the deepest recesses of the self." Here's a poem for today by Jen Levitt entitled On Turning 30. No one microwaves leftovers we order in. I haven't prayed since 1996. In temple, the cantor was always tuning her guitar, and the metal folding chairs squeaked. Is hypnosis dead? I feel about as sexual as a frying pan. At this age, Sylvia had sheaves of poems, 2 kids, and my aura drips like a sieve. According to the internet, the small ache in our chest derives from artificial sweeteners, anxiety, too much aptitude. Better that than bad genes or apathy. I wish I thought I'd be married by now. A poem by Jen Levitt, On Turning 30, from her collection The Off-Season, published by 4-Way Books and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation, publisher of Poetry Magazine, committed to discovering great poets and printing their verse. Back issues and subscriptions available at poetrymagazine.org. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
air we breathe, the water we drink, the climate that makes it possible for humans to thrive. These are things that are under stress in our changing world. So what's a person to do? Well, you can tune in to Living on Earth. Hi, I'm Steve Hurwood, and every week we keep you informed of the choices you can make to make a better life for you, your family, and your community. That's Living on Earth from PRI.
Sundays at 2 on KTOO News.
It's 26 minutes past the hour, and you are tuned to Juno Afternoon. That voice that you heard belongs to Steve Hurwood. For over 24 years, KTOO has carried Living on Earth. Presently, we have a show at Sunday at 2 in the afternoon. I'm pleased to welcome to KTOO Studios the host of the program, Steve Hurwood. Steve, welcome to Juno.
Well, thank you. Glad to be here, Jeff.
First question, what brings you to the capital city?
To sit in your studio and look out and see a waterfall. I don't know if there are any other studios where you can look out the window and see the waterfalls the way that you have here. No, seriously, Jeff, we're looking at the Tongass and the bid by the state here to get some 2 million acres under state control as opposed to being part of the federal national forest, the politics of that and the ecology of that.
How did Living on Earth start?
I met a scientist by the name of George Woodwell. As I was working on a book project, I thought about climate change. And this was 1989. And Dr. Woodwell said to me, well, it's all very good, well, good that you're interested in this, Steve, but he ticked off a bunch of people who were already writing books and knew more about it. And I said, doggone it, nobody's talking about this on the radio, so I can do this on the radio. And that got me going.
Was it a segment in a larger show at the very beginning?
No, actually, we did this as a standalone. The reason we did it as a standalone is that I knew the politics of media was such that we wouldn't have the world's most amazing ratings, that this tremendous pushback, but also it's... you know, it would be very tempting for broadcast brass to say, you know, all right, we've done this environment thing for a while. Let's move on to something else. Indeed, that's the reason why we're in trouble dealing with the environment today, is that people often say, well, you know, we've kind of dealt with that. So I said, no, we should do this standalone. I didn't come up with a new format. I spent some time hosting Weekend All Things Considered earlier. And so I took pretty much that news magazine format and just talked about environmental change in that. So we didn't go for innovative programming, but we did go for an innovative subject, which was ridiculously undercovered at the time.
How many stations carry it now?
There are about 250 stations that carry us.
Has it changed over the years?
It has. We do probably a little bit longer segments. We're almost counterculture for a lot of public radio. Things keep getting shorter and shorter. And we're doing longer interviews with people. We go a little bit deeper if you've written a book or you're looking at some scientific revelation. It's tough to get it all in 3.5 or 4.5 minutes. We don't go as long as Terry Gross. We don't take the entire time, but we like to take some time. So that part has changed. We were a half-hour show, and now we're an hour. And before there wasn't podcasting, and we put ourselves out as a podcast. A lot has actually changed, now that you mention it, Jeff, because there's an algorithm that you can use a cell phone to record somebody. They can record themselves, and you get almost broadcast quality when you get the file back. So increasingly, we're using less and less of telephone quality and hearing people more in full quality, which is cool because occasionally you get to interview somebody really interesting, like, say, James Cameron, the guy that did the movie, The Titanic, and everything. And getting onto his schedule is not easy, but because all he had to have was a phone in one hand and an iPhone recording himself in the other, we got the interview, and we're getting that more and more.
With the controversy surrounding global warming and other discussions about science and political scene, how has the world of politics affected your show?
Oh, my. Let's see. There's only 24 hours in the day, and so where do I start on
this
that?
This is one of those long interviews.
Well, yeah, this is all very political. I mean, I mentioned that I'm here to look at the Tongass. Because the political pressure here is, look, the price of oil is down, you know, so maybe some timber can come back, right? Because the state rules would allow clear cutting in areas of the national forest that wouldn't be permitted now. And so the politics of this are really pretty intense, because on the other side you have research that shows that the Tongass is a carbon sink. It absorbs carbon out of the atmosphere, as opposed to what's happening way north in Alaska, where the boreal forest is on fire. I think a few weeks ago there was one day that 300,000 acres burned. So this resource here, ecologically, is very, very important. And then for the human enterprise to deal with the threat of climate change, it's very, very important. And the decision is going to be made politically. Politically.
Do you feel the show is... presents itself as unbiased?
Well, I do. But we get criticized by people because they think that talking about the environment, one must be biased. And to a certain extent, I have to agree with that. If, for example, you say that somebody who covers, say, sports, you know, if I were a sports reporter but I thought it was ridiculous for grown men and women to chase a small piece of horsehide, it'd be kind of... You know, or let's say about somebody who covers business. If you think that capitalism is stupid, why would you be a business reporter? So I think that the environment is extremely important. But it's my job as a journalist to tell the story. I don't have the answers. I don't have the solutions. I talk to people who talk about the challenges, who have some proposed solutions. But the one thing that I know from my years as a reporter, actually two things that I know, Jeff. One is you got to have a well-informed press to have the democracy work. Because if people vote, they vote on the basis of what they know. And if they know the accurate story, then they can make what will be wiser decisions. If they don't get the good story, then they'll make poor decisions. And that responsibility is why the press is in the United States Constitution. The other thing that I've learned over time is that pretty much there's so many things that I know, or I think I know, when you turn around and you do more reporting or time moves on, it's very different. I started covering the environment and this show with the notion that, well, sometime in the future we might see the effects of climate disruption and climate change. This was like a future thing. And right now we're already feeling it. Right now, here in Alaska, well, just offshore, in this so-called blob, I saw one of your reporters had a nice write-up about this. Sea temperatures... 5, 6, 7 degrees warmer than in the past, which has a huge impact in a large area like that. And the northern part of this planet is warming a lot faster than the rest of the planet, maybe 3 times faster. And I didn't think that I'd see that in my lifetime, or I'd have to be a very old guy in a rocking chair to see. I'm seeing it now.
As a journalist, what's your perspective to the recent conventions?
Okay, so I'm talking... You want me to talk about a media perspective of how that worked journalistic, or do you want my opinion as to what happened and what I saw?
I settle for your opinion.
Okay. You're very generous, Jeff. Thank you. I think that people got to see who these people really are in this convention process. So on the Trump side, what happened to the Republicans, you saw a number of people not come. There was no George Bush, the elder. There was no George Bush, the younger. There was no Jeb Bush. There was a whole bunch of... There was no John McCain. There was no Mitt Romney. There were... The Republican leadership of many, many years on a national basis didn't show. And you saw Mr. Trump bring out some reality TV stars, many members of his family, and was short on a fair amount of substance. And it was very negative and fearful. Very negative and fearful. The Democratic convention that just wound up, there were a whole range of people of political prominence who were there in the Democratic Party. Not just Hillary Clinton's family that includes a former president, but in fact, the leading opponent, Bernie Sanders, who put on an amazing campaign, who really pushed the Democratic Party to grapple with issues like climate, for example, and what's going on with the wars. He had a very prominent role. You know, the Republican top opponent came to the thing and dissed it. So, actually, Jeff, this points out a big problem. The Republicans are dysfunctional. So that all just means that the Democrats really don't have there's not a smart opposition to take on the Democrats, a credible, straightforward set of folks outside of the Democrats. The Republicans, by going the Trump way, have really marginalized themselves as credible. So the opposition that the Dems have is internal. So I'm very curious to see, as a journalist now, what the new Republican Party will evolve into, what we will see. It's not lost on me historically, by the way, that, you know, Abraham Lincoln was elected, was the first Republican elected. The Whigs had collapsed. They were trying to deal with the problem of slavery. Slavery was a period of time when we enslaved people. I'm African American, so it's rather on the personal side as well. We bought and sold people. Right now, we're dealing with a crisis over enslaving nature. We think that it's okay for us to buy and sell nature. Nature's starting to remind us, by things like climate change and there are other changes in the biota that we could talk about, that we need to be respectful and we need to be caring about it. And the political fight over climate change is, of course, about the energy system that we have and the use of fossil fuel and the great wealth that's been built that way. And here in Alaska is huge wealth that's been built with fossil fuel, and there's a huge amount of pain now that the price of oil has gone down, and there's much more pain to come. And that gets in the way of looking at the reality of, is it, we decided it wasn't right for us to own people, and as a society we're moving to the point where it's not okay for us to think we own nature. We are a part of nature. We don't own it. And so the Democratic Party is moving in that direction. There's still, you know, the nominee, Hillary Clinton, very friendly to the fossil fuel interests, but speaking out about climate disruption. Here in Alaska and in coal country, I think we have an important lesson to learn based on how we ended slavery. At the time of slavery, a functional slave was worth as much or more than a nice car, brand new car. The wealth of the South on the plantations was greater for the slaves than it was for the land. But at the end, towards the Civil War, only 4% of the population owned slaves. So 96% weren't in this. The economic disruption that happened to the South because of that abrupt collapse, that whole system, all that wealth went away. It's just, it's so painful that actually we're still seeing the aftermath of it. In changing the energy system to renewable and much more nature-safe processes, we should not be making, and this is my opinion, we should not be making the same mistake. We need to, in Appalachia, we need to hold up those people who dug the coal so that we could have lights for generations and build this industrial society. Those people should not be kicked to the curb. They did what we wanted them to do, and they sacrificed from black lung or whatever. The same here in Alaska, for example, with the oil infrastructure that's here. I mean, Alaska has been pumping this oil for America for how long? And supporting our national security with that oil. Now science tells us that the burning of fossil fuels is making problems for the planet. We really need to get out of that game. Is it fair or right for the people who, and communities and families and whole states that built their economies around this and need to make the change? Is it fair just to kick them to the curb? In my view, no. We need to not just not do a little, we need to do a lot to be sure that there is not the kind of agony and disruption that was so toxic, really, for the South after the Civil War, getting rid of slavery. We can be smarter than that. we're developing new industries. There's a whole new jobs in the renewable energy field, and there's so many other things that's happening, a new development in this society, that we can support people in doing this. We don't have to do this the old way. We don't have to say to folks, well, you know, oil's gone, so, oh, we got to slash the state budget, or, you know, you're out of a job and you're going to have to make it. No, we don't have to do that. This is the richest country on the planet. We have vast, vast, vast resources. We have so much stuff to do just to rebuild our infrastructure. Of course, you can't get a road in and out of this town, but, you know, most of the rest of the country, there's a lot of roads, bridges, schools, hospitals. And my favorite thing in the infrastructure question, Jeff, is about electricity and the renewable electricity. There's if you listen to Living on Earth a few months ago, you would have heard this meteorologist, these guys that do weather research in Boulder, there's a National Weather Research Center there. And they did the math, and they said that if we had a true national grid that connected all parts of the country in electricity, within 15 years we could have 80% renewable energy. Because someplace the wind is blowing, someplace the sun is shining. So all we need is a national, truly national grid, which requires a DC technology. It's a tremendous amount of money, of course, to have that, right? Well, there are the jobs. And I bet you right now that even you or I, and certainly somebody listening to us right now, if they could buy a bond for that national grid for renewable energy, if they could take some of this, if they could make that investment, they'd be happy to lend the money for that. We've had war bonds in this country to support major efforts. We have school bonds to support things. We have highway. Why not renewable energy infrastructure? And that's a huge number. That's just a huge number of jobs. And we could go on and on and on about the jobs that are out there. So I hope that this time, as we make this transition, it's a huge transition for this society, this energy thing, that we don't repeat these mistakes of just discarding people who did the stuff for us for so long and that we used very well. You know, right now in this town, my guess is there are a few Teslas. I think everybody's driving on oil here, almost everybody. So we need it. Right now we need it, but we're not going to need it for much longer. But let's not discard the people that make it possible for us to do what we're doing right now because of what we need to do in the future.
I'm talking with Steve Curwood. He's the host and producer of Living on Earth, which airs on KTOO at 2 o'clock on Sunday afternoons. Could you talk real quickly about the upcoming symposium on the ocean?
Oh, okay. Yeah, this is
going to start in the next few days.
Yeah, this is going to be on Nantucket Island when I go back east. We'll be going to be talking both about fish and about some of the legal issues around the ocean. The legal issues first. There's something called the Law of the Sea Treaty that Republicans, by the way, Elliot Richardson, who was a Republican governor of Massachusetts when he was in the State Department, negotiated with the rest of the world, and things like the 200-mile zone and all that were in it. But the U.S. has never ratified it. We never ratified this thing. We've never agreed to it, even though we developed the framework for this. This big international arrangement, the Law of the Sea. Right now, we're very strong militarily, so people really don't try to mess with us. But it could help us right now if, you know, there's a military thing brewing in the South China Sea. If we had the Law of the Sea Treaty, there would be much more clarity, international clarity, about how we deal with situations like that. So we're going to talk about the need to address the commons, the last of the commons on the planet. You know, 50% of the ocean is not under the control of any one country. And very rapidly, whether it's because it's becoming acidified, whether because the temperature is changing, or whether there's technology and military, it's really important. The other part, of course, is about the fish. This is John Duff, a lawyer, and actually a guy who's done some stuff for the program, a faculty guy at UMass Boston, but also been a faculty fellow with the show. We'll talk about the legal stuff. And then Carl Safina, who wrote a book called The Song for Blue Ocean, was a really gifted guy in the oceans, a biologist, going to talk about sustainable fisheries and how we do this. Going to be very proud, by the way, about Alaska, because you guys in Alaska, you have the most sustainable fishery that we have in America, what you can do out in the Bering Sea and such. And how is it that we can restore and renew the rest of the fisheries that we have access to meet the standard that you folks have set here in Alaska? So we'll be talking about that.
Is that going to be available online?
Yes. As a matter of fact, I just was dealing with an email from one of my producers saying, questions about how we get that recorded. So we will post it, and folks will be able to hear.
If people are concerned about the environment, what are some of the things they can do besides listen to Living on Earth, of course?
One thing is to vote. Because if you don't vote, the decision is being made anyway. And there's not a right way or a wrong way. It's, you know, the best that you're informed, please vote, because then that way you're part of the discussion. On a personal level for environmental care, there are some very simple things to do. One is to take some direct action on this climate thing. There's about as much carbon emitted in the transportation sector as there is in the agricultural sector, particularly in the meat-eating sector. So if you, one day a week, you don't have meat, that's about the same as not driving that day. Of course, I don't know what vehicle you have, and I don't have, you know, this is a very general, this is a gross generalization, but it's on that scale. So start by either not driving that gasoline-powered vehicle one day, or carpooling, or if you can go electric. Actually, the roads aren't very long here. You'd do very well with a simple electric vehicle around here. And or eat just a little less meat. And by the way, fish has much less of an impact than red meat. I haven't seen any cattle ranches around here, so I imagine it's rather expensive to get that stuff shipped in to begin with.
And keep them in the back 40.
Okay.
Real quick, what's next?
For the program or what we're doing?
You personally.
Personally? You know, that's the great thing about journalism is that I can tell you, of course, we're going to be covering this election. We're working on this story here about what happens to these public lands. We've got a reporter going to the south of India, Kerala, which is very poor but has a 90-95% literacy rate and uses something called permaculture to avoid the use of fertilizers, and it actually helps sequester carbon in the soil. I should mention, by the way, that most of the carbon in the soil here, and virtually everywhere, most of the carbon that's in the tongass, I meant to say, is in the soil, three times as much as in the trees. But it's part of a system that keeps building up that soil. You take away the trees, and the carbon starts to come out. So you have to keep the trees in order to keep all that carbon in the soil. So that's very important. So we'll be looking at agriculture, food production, and that. But the thing that's wonderful about journalism, and scary sometimes too, is that you just have no idea what could be coming down the pike. Something changes, and then somebody says, okay, well, what are you going to tell us about it? You, Mr. Journalist, you're supposed to know about these things. What are you going to do?
Steve Kerwin, thank you so much for being with us today. You can hear Steve Kerwin on his show, Living on Earth, Sundays at 2 o'clock in the afternoon here on KTOO News, you know.
Thank you, Jeff.
It's Mike Aldridge and friends. Dynasty 51 and you are tuned to Juneau Afternoon here. Listener supported KTO News Juneau. In the studio with me, we have Emma Davidson and also Brian Fairley from Canvas here to talk about the spelling workshop, which is going on tomorrow. Thanks for coming by the station today.
Yeah, thanks for having us. Really excited.
So could you describe a little bit of what felting is?
So felting is taking sheep's wool or alpaca's wool and turning it into an actual material. So you take a raw fleece and either through wet felting or dry felting, which tomorrow we'll be doing dry felting, using needles, you turn it into a wonderful creature or, you know, whatever you want it to be.
So, and tomorrow you're making a menagerie.
Yeah, so tomorrow we're going to be making some different critters. We have tons of wonderful wildlife that surround us that I like to draw inspiration from. And so, yeah, be using that to...
And it's something that you don't need to be a scientist to...
Definitely not. Nope. This is something that you can come in having no idea what this material is and just come out with such a successful piece, which is what's really great about felt making.
Can you tell me a little bit about your background?
So I am from the East Coast. I went to school at Savannah College of Art and Design, and I studied fibers and printmaking there. And I've kind of hopped around the East Coast a little bit, lived in a couple of different states, and I've been here since the beginning of February, and I'm here until about December. It's very exciting.
Tim is our resident artist this year at the Canvas. Each year we have an artist who works with the community and some of our artists that we have in our day programming. And she's also doing our September art show. She'll be filling the gallery with some work she's been doing inspired by Juno during her stay.
Brian, why don't you tell me a little bit about your background?
My background. I am originally from Kodiak, and I moved here this spring to work at the Canvas, and I help run the front gallery and manage some of the programming, working with Brandon and Kelly and Mercedes and all of our artists. And right now we're working on our fall programming. We've got a bunch of new classes, especially for adults. A lot of people have been asking for adult classes because we've been focusing on the kids during the summertime, and we're wrapping that up next week. So it's time to move on to the adults now that the kids are going to school.
What are some of the adults classes?
Well, Emma, we're actually booking up for a few classes coming up. Maybe she can talk about some of those. We've got some 4-week classes.
This fall, we're going to be doing some silk painting, making just, you know, incredibly beautiful scarves, doing some more felting classes, but this time a little bit different. We're going to be doing felted landscapes where we'll be wet felting and pulling from the landscapes that Juno has to offer. And then we're also going to be doing a mixed media printmaking class where we're going to be using a greener lithographic process to make additions and then make them varied by using color pencil, watercolor, maybe even sewing into them and kind of just, you know, having a lot of fun and experimenting.
What other forms of art do you practice?
I do a lot of illustrations that then usually turn into some kind of silk painting or printmaking. Those are kind of the two worlds I hang out in, but I love mixed media, and I love combining a lot of different materials to create pieces. Definitely more fine art than sculptural. Yeah.
How many pieces can we look forward to seeing next First Friday?
Well, I've been working on a couple of different series that will be in the show in September. And then this upcoming First Friday, we actually have some of the artists that we work with on the daily, Mark Davis and Mirov Menafee and Niall Johnson. They are going to be having a show that I'm really excited about.
Cool. Is there anything you'd like to add about for you on the ask?
About?
Let's talk about tomorrow's class. What time
tomorrow's class? Tomorrow's class starts at 10:30. There's still reservation space available. It'd be best if you do it online today. Get signed up at canvasarts.org. It's basically it goes from 10:30 until 3 p.m. And there's about an hour break in there if people want to, or they could keep working. It's only $20 for the kid and a parent. So that's the other thing we should mention. It's a parent and kid class, which is kind of unusual. Usually we do kids or parents, and this time we're kind of combining the whole family. So everybody's invited to work together. Each can make their own animal.
Yeah, so we'll probably start in the morning. We'll start making an animal together. I usually start with an owl. That gives us a basic idea for how to make different shapes. And then once we've completed that, we can kind of make whatever animal your heart desires.
We've done this class a few times now, and there's been some pretty cool creatures, whales and foxes.
Even some spirits that don't exist in our natural world.
All right, I appreciate you coming by.
Oh, thank you.
This is Bird Note. Have you noticed a sleek, stub-tailed bird pecking its way down a tree trunk? It's probably a nuthatch. It might remind you of a tiny woodpecker, but woodpeckers travel up the trunk, leaning on their tails. Where did this bird get a name like nuthatch? Perhaps because this tiny songbird tucks insects, nuts, and seeds under bark or in crevices of trees. Then it hacks the tidbits apart with repetitive strikes of its beak, like using a hatchet. Of the four nuthatch species living in the United States, the most common are the red-breasted nuthatch and the white-breasted nuthatch. The nuthatch's insistent call matches its aggressiveness. These tough little guys will challenge birds larger than themselves for food and territory. Birds gathered around a feeder give way when a nuthatch is around. And that business of working its way down a tree trunk? It's a clever move, because the nuthatch can spot and eat all the tasty morsels missed by the rest of the birds working their way up the tree. There's more to learn about nuthatches, and you can see photos, when you come to our website, birdnote.org. I'm Mary McCann.
Weather forecast for tonight, scattered rain showers in the evening, then isolated rain showers after midnight. Patchy fog after midnight with low temperatures around 50 degrees. Forecast for Saturday, mostly cloudy skies with patchy fog. Sunday, partly sunny, high temperatures in the mid-60s. Forecast for Sunday night, mostly cloudy skies.
This is KTO.